Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Are quickly taking up one of the thorniest issues they've had to confront, how to create a new way to deal with Guantanamo Bay detainees. Late last month, the Supreme Court ruled that the secretive military commissions established by the Bush administration to try terrorist suspects are illegal under U.S. and international law. So this week, lawmakers will begin to address the issue by holding several committee hearings. What will the political and legal fallout be? Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Dmitry Savastopoulos, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. Welcome, Dmitry.
Thank you, Robin.
And we've heard of at least three ways that lawmakers are going about this. Can you sketch them out, starting with lawmakers who want to keep things the way they are?
Sure. Like you said, there are three options. The Supreme Court has said to President Bush that the military commissions that he set up to try the detainees at Guantanamo Bay are unlawful under U.S. law and also under the Geneva Conventions. Now, there are three things that could happen. Either Congress could come back and work out a solution that would approve the current military commissions and essentially say, we authorize President Bush to do this.
Essentially changing the U.S. law.
They would change the U.S. law to do that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns there is that if you enact the commissions the way they are at the moment, that a lot of international allies who've been very critical of the system are going to be even more critical. And I think increasingly President Bush is concerned about the reaction from overseas to the way the people are being treated at Guantanamo and the procedures in place to try them.
Well, the question to you, they may be unhappy in the international world, but if the lawmakers change U.S. law to make it legal under U.S. law, doesn't the Supreme Court ruling still stand in saying that it's illegal under the Geneva Conventions? I mean, how do they get around that?
Well, they would have to. What the Supreme Court has said, and there's a lot of legal ambiguity here, and it's sometimes difficult to read these decisions, but what the Supreme Court seems to have said is that the commission set up at the moment violate the Geneva Conventions because the Geneva Conventions require you to have some kind of a normal court, which the Supreme Court seems to suggest is the court-martials that are generally used in military proceedings. Now, it's possible that Congress could try to adjust the commissions to include some of the court-martial rules and to bring them closer to what would be acceptable under the Geneva Conventions. But one of the problems then is that the detainees down at Guantanamo, through their lawyers, may file lawsuits again, and you back into this process of multiple lawsuits and a long time before you get any solution.
Well, let's in fact jump in here and explain the difference between the military commissions that have been set up by the Bush administration, ruled illegal by the Supreme Court, and courts martial. What are the primary differences?
The main difference is, first of all, the court martials are promulgated under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They are fairly similar to the kind of courts, trials you would see in a civilian court or federal court. The two main differences are that under the military commissions that have been set up at Guantanamo, the detainee is not entitled to be present at all of the proceedings, and they are not entitled to see a lot of the evidence presented against them. And also the kind of evidence that can be introduced is there's a lower standard. You can introduce hearsay into the military commissions, which you cannot do into a court-martial or into a federal court.
Yeah. Well, let's outline now. So you say there's a group of lawmakers who want to keep things pretty much the way they are, give the president the authority to set up the military commissions that are already there. Two, there are people who want to have the military commissions modeled more on courts martial systems. And in between are Republicans and Democrats who are just trying to tweak things a little bit. What are some of the other tweakings that this group is looking at?
The tweakings might include, for example, taking the court martial as your baseline and then changing the rules a little bit so that you might, for example, exclude certain kinds of evidence, saying that this kind of classified evidence cannot be introduced or cannot be shown to the detainee. The problem is the further you move away from the court martial in enacting these tweaks, the closer you get to the commissions, and you raise again the possibility that the Supreme Court will not like the outcome.
And doesn't one of the tweaks have to do with evidence of torture?
Yes, I mean, you cannot, at the moment, under a court-martial, you cannot introduce evidence that's been extracted from torture or harsh methods of interrogation. Under the military commissions, that's permissible. So you could have a possible change there, too. But again, if you allowed a situation where evidence gained by torture was allowed, I think you would probably have a problem with the courts again. So it's a difficult balance that needs to be struck, both for Congress and actually also for the administration in working with Congress to get a solution.
What is the White House saying?
The White House is saying that we're still digesting the opinion. We are trying to work with Congress to come up with a solution that satisfies the courts, but they haven't given any indication as to what they might actually do.
And what are legal experts saying? This seems like a very sticky wicket for this highly controlled, in the past, administration to be in.
Well, the first point legal experts would make is that this was a huge rebuke by the Supreme Court to the Bush administration. The second thing they're saying is that there are certain things that the Supreme Court said that are clear, which is that the military commissions, as currently structured, are unlawful and breach the Geneva Conventions. But after that, there's a lot of disagreement. I mean, for example, one of the questions that still is being debated is, did the Supreme Court say that the Geneva Conventions, and specifically Article 3, apply to all detainees captured in the war on terror, or very narrowly only to detainees who are being tried at Guantanamo under these commissions? So, for example, some people say detainees at Guantanamo who have not been brought before a commission, and remember that so far only 10 people have been lined up for commission proceedings, that everyone else is not entitled to Geneva Convention protections. And I think there's going to be a debate over that, and any change in law in the Congress is going to have to take that into account.
Well, meanwhile, what's the timeline? How long do they have? How long before, was there anything in the Supreme Court ruling that said these detainees had to be released? I mean, what happens?
No, the opinion was clear in saying that it said nothing about whether the detainees should be released. It does not alter President Bush's authority under a previous Supreme Court ruling to maintain or detain these prisoners at Guantanamo indefinitely while the war on terror continues. But it's clear that the administration wants to come to a solution as quickly as possible. And I think at the moment, people on Capitol Hill are looking to have some kind of legislation in place, hopefully by September.
Well, briefly, while we have you, we just want to ask you about another matter that's gotten a lot of attention. This weekend, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, was asked to explain an angry letter that he wrote to President Bush last May, demanding to know why he, Hoekstra, wasn't briefed about a secret intelligence program. Now, all the talk has been about what program he was referring to. A New York Times report quoted anonymous officials saying the program was not the domestic spying program and it wasn't the SWIFT banking surveillance program. What does that leave?
Well, what we don't know is the short answer. I mean, it could be anything. I mean, there have been, for example, if you remember in The New Yorker a few years ago, Cy Hirsch had a piece saying that the administration had authorized a covert program, I think it was called Copper Green or something like that, which allowed the CIA to detain people around the world in secret locations and use very coercive methods of interrogation. I mean, could it be that? Could it be something else? We simply don't know. But I think the underlying point here is that the intelligence committees on Capitol Hill, both Republican members and Democrats, are increasingly concerned that they're being kept out of the loop on intelligence issues that they're supposed to have oversight over. And they're getting increasingly upset with the administration about that.
Dimitri Sevastopoulos, Washington correspondent for the Financial Times. Dimitri, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now to Tibet, which travel agents in China hope will be a new rallying cry. The 2,500 miles that separate Beijing from Chinese Tibet are now connected by the world's highest railroad. The SkyTrain is a literally breathtaking feat of engineering, running over hundreds of miles of permafrost, sometimes over 16,000 feet in the air. The cabins are pressurized with extra oxygen to ward off altitude sickness, but still many travelers become very ill. This new rail link is part of what China is calling its Great Leap West. West, in this case, being the resource-rich and sparsely populated provinces of western China, including Tibet. The Chinese say the train will bring economic development to Tibet, but many Tibetans worry it will only bring more ethnic Chinese to take their jobs and land. Here to explain is Dr. Lapsang Sangay. He's Tibetan and a fellow in East Asian Legal Studies at Harvard University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this SkyTrain first, because it becomes metaphor, but it's also a very practical illustration of what China is, how it is interacting with Tibet. We heard pens were exploding, people were very sick. Is there a sense that the train's going to work?
Now, there are a lot of challenges. For example, at the 5,000 meters high, most of the train tracks were built on what they call permafrost, that's frozen land. But recently, some scientists from the Chinese Academy of Social Science have said that with the global warming, the permafrost will be affected, and within 10 years, the train track cannot hold.
Well, the Chinese government's gone out of its way to say that it listened to environmentalists, that it protected the wildlife, that it built all sorts of bridges and things so that the train wouldn't disturb the environment that much. But as we said, it stands as a metaphor for many people of how China is imposing new technology, new ways onto Tibet in this Great Leap West policy. Tell us more about that and how it applies to Tibet.
Yeah, the Chinese government policy is that the coastal provinces of China are far more developed than the inner part of China.
Far more developed.
So they are coming out with this, you know, go west or develop west policy. However, the Tibetan side of the argument is that this development per se, it does not necessarily benefit Tibetan people. For example, in Tibet so far, the development has so far taken place in urban areas where 90% of the Chinese migrants move to urban areas. Mm. And whereas 80% of the Tibetan population are in rural areas, but the development projects in rural areas are, to say the least, marginal.
So the thinking on the part of the Tibetans is that this policy is just going to benefit the ethnic Chinese to get them out of the already strained Chinese cities, but into Tibetan cities.
If you do a comparative analysis with Inner Mongolia and Xinjiang, East Turkestan, it's very clear that wherever there's a railway track, more Chinese are moved in and settled in.
So the Tibetans are saying, oh, this isn't helping us at all because most of us work in the countryside. This is just bringing ethnic Chinese into our cities and making our cities look like Chinese cities. How does that translate for you? What does that mean to a Tibetan when you say it's making Lhasa, for instance, the capital of Tibet, look just like a Chinese city?
Lhasa has a population of around 400,000, of which 50% are Chinese. Now, with the train track, they expect 3,000 to 4,000 quote-unquote tourists to come every day, and in a year they expect 800,000 tourists to come to Tibet.
You say quote-unquote. The Tibetans don't view these as tourists. They view them as Chinese coming
Chinese
in.
Migrants, yeah, right. Too. Now the Chinese government spent $4.2 billion to build this railway line. Mm. However, more than 90% of the employees were from outside Tibet. The implementation didn't benefit Tibetans, right? Very planning was done in Beijing and implemented in Tibet. So Tibetans kind of are skeptical in that sense. They fear that it might be just another train track that has happened in Xinjiang and where and in Mongolia, where the local population were overwhelmed by Chinese influx.
We're talking about Tibet and the new high-altitude Chinese train connecting Tibet to China with Dr. Labsang Sangay, a fellow in East Asian Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and a Tibetan. Now, most governments, including the U.S., accept the Chinese definition of Tibet as a province of China with some degree of autonomy. Tibetans have a wider definition, which includes the many Tibetans outside the region and the idea of an independent Tibetan nation. But in recent talks with China, the Dalai Lama, the exiled Tibetan leader, has been willing to settle for greater autonomy and not outright independence. Well, coming up, how those talks and that seeming compromise may be radicalizing a frustrated Tibetan youth. And much more coming up here and now. Beijing to the capital of Chinese Tibet. The Chinese government sees the train as a way to develop Tibet's economy. Tibetans worry that they'll be inundated by Chinese workers and culture. Our guest is Dr. Labsang Sangay, a fellow in East Asian Legal Studies at Harvard University and a Tibetan. And Dr. Labsang, as we said, this is part of what China calls its Great Leap West. And it sounds a lot like, go west, young man, the expression of manifest destiny here in the U.S. Are the Chinese borrowing from the American playbook?
Actually, when you interact with Chinese scholars, especially Americans do, they often come up with this argument that, don't blame us for what we're doing in Tibet. You did the same to the Native Indians. But from what America has done to Native Indians, from the mistakes, it's very blatantly clear. The Chinese government should learn lessons from it, and then try to implement their projects in a more constructive, more progressive, more beneficial to the Tibetan people.
One of your concerns is that the rail line will dilute Tibetan culture. But some who use the line say, if not us, then globalization will do that. There is no culture that can keep the world at bay. Why do you think it's important that Tibetans do keep the world at bay?
Yeah, first of all, Tibetans are not against development or modernization per se. I mean, every culture evolves. But what Tibetans are saying is that it has to evolve on our terms.
But further, you're saying that it's important that the development benefit Tibetans, but also not dilute what people expect Tibet to look like. Tell us more about that.
When His Holiness Dalai Lama says that Tibetan culture should be preserved, you know, it's a win-win-win proposal. For example, the Chinese tourists, the millions of them who come to Tibet, they don't want to see Chinese building, Chinese town, Chinese-speaking people, Chinese dress like, you know. What they want to see is Tibetan culture. At least what they should want to see mm-hmm. is Tibetan culture.
And what would that be? How would you describe what they would want to see?
As much as possible, you have Tibetan architecture, you know, Tibetan dress, Tibetan-speaking people, Tibetan cuisine, Tibetan food, Tibetan hotel. Mm-hmm. At least you go to a place. You must have this aesthetic taste to know and to be curious about and interact with the local people there, and you take a piece of it back. You know? Mm-hmm. Not that you come and stay in Chinese hotel and Chinese restaurant and go back. You have the same experience, mm-hmm. just that you went to a very high place called Tibet and had altitude sickness. That's all you can take back, you know. So the preservation of Tibetan culture is good for local economy in Tibet and good for Chinese tourists to see, and good for Tibetan people to, you know, preserve, you know, the thousands of years of civilization, which ought to be preserved, but should evolve and will evolve, but on our terms.
Well, Dr. Labsang, we understand that all the debate over the train unfolds as there is apparently behind-the-scenes negotiations between the exiled Dalai Lama and the Chinese over his possible return. Now, we understand those talks are stalled, but just to give a little background here, when the Chinese first invaded Tibet in 1949, they said they were liberating Tibet from what was a feudal, unjust society. Tibetans acknowledged that there was a feudal society at that time. And apparently, the Dalai Lama has, with his followers in exile in India, have formed a more democratic approach to government, and they've been talking with the Chinese about his possible return. So can you tell us, you know, what the goal of those talks is if they resume?
There has been 5 delegations since October of 2002. They have been to Tibet. They have been to Beijing and other places to have dialogue with the Chinese government to test whether there could be a breakthrough, an eventual negotiation to resolve the issue of Tibet once and for all. In these 5 meetings so far, it seems they have discussed on all major issues like the definition of autonomy. What does definition of autonomy mean to exiled Tibetans and the Chinese side of the argument? And what does Tibet mean, demarcation of Tibet? Because Chinese definition of Tibet includes only Tibet Autonomous Region, whereas exiled Tibetans' definition of Tibet includes Tibetan people living in neighboring states as well. So, and then the status of Dalai Lama, return of Dalai Lama. So far, they have discussed all the major issues, but in the 5th meeting, there was fundamental differences in the approach. The Tibetan side wanted to discuss first on minor issues, for example, the releasing of political prisoners, mm-hmm. of, you know, language or environment, or, you know, the His Holiness Dalai Lama could visit pilgrimage sites in China, things like that. Mm-hmm. But the Chinese side wanted to resolve the major issues first, then only discuss minor issues. So there has been a fundamental differences in the approach. The hope of His Holiness Dalai Lama is that there could be a resolution whereby Tibetans could gain autonomy, genuine autonomy.
As opposed to independence.
As opposed to independence within the framework of the Chinese constitution, whereby Tibetans could self-administer the region and preserve the language, culture, mm-hmm. And have a majority in the administration of Tibetan people.
Right. Do you fear that there might be a split within Tibet between those who might want a more radical more radical approach towards China than even the Dalai Lama wants to at this point?
It's very clear that Tibetan youth, students, younger generation are increasingly frustrated and are skeptical with the Chinese government, and they are getting radicalized, you know. For example, His Holiness has been talking about, you know, resolving this issue for the last 22 years, and not much result has been born out of it. Mm-hmm. And younger generation are saying it's futile, it's useless. We must resort and claim what is our birthright, which is independence, and a possible resort to the violence. Mm-hmm. And there isn't a group which is advocating or clearly outlining plan per se. But there is a lot of talk among younger generation getting radicalized. If that happens, that will be unfortunate for the Chinese government, because that will destabilize the region, and unfortunate for Tibetans people also, because that means there will be a lot of bloodshed, and then violence begets violence, and then it will be a cycle. That will be an unfortunate future that we would like to see. Mm. In that sense, it is in the best interest of the Chinese government to resolve the Tibetan issue while His Holiness the Lama is alive.
Dr. Lobsang Sangay, a fellow in East Asian Legal Studies at Harvard University here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Lobsang, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
And a quick program note here. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Roots Rock. It's alive and kicking with bands like the Bottle Rockets and Detroit's Dead String Brothers. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Senate hearings across the country. Today, the Senate Armed Services Committee is taking testimony in Miami. But meanwhile, some communities across the nation are taking matters into their own hands, with two Massachusetts towns taking opposite approaches. Cambridge, home to Harvard, redeclared itself a sanctuary city in May. The declaration says that as long as immigrants in Cambridge don't commit crimes, they shouldn't be hassled by police and other city officials. We'll have more on that in a moment, but first, on Cape Cod, the town of Sandwich is sounding its own alarm. Selectmen there approved a motion that the town be declared not a sanctuary for illegal aliens. The motion, which says legal immigrants are welcome, must be approved by town meeting in the fall to go on the books. Randy Hunt chairs the Sandwich Board of Selectmen, which approved the motion unanimously. And Randy, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, you're very welcome, Robin.
And the motion was offered by Selectman Douglas Dexter. He says in the beginning of the motion, it's very clear that our country is now in the midst of one of the greatest threats to its existence in our history. There are millions of criminal aliens invading our cities and towns and destroying the social services and legal systems of our communities. Is that true in Sandwich? Are illegal immigrants flocking to Sandwich?
Well, we don't have a huge influx of illegal aliens or immigrants as you might think, in this little town that's a tourist destination on Cape Cod.
Why then, since there doesn't seem to be a big population there, and most of the people who've been quoted from the area would say the same thing, why did you and other board members think that this motion was necessary?
I am a CPA. I have clients from Sandwich and all over Cape Cod, and many of those are contractors who do jobs like roofing, like painting, landscaping, etc. And a lot of them are now telling me that it's coming to a point where it's nearly impossible for them to compete with businesses that are hiring illegal immigrants to do work, primarily because they're not paying workers' compensation, they're not paying unemployment insurance, they're paying cash under the table, so they're not paying Social Security on these people.
Well, as everyone here in New England knows, the Cape relies on immigrant work in the summer to function. And employers say in response to that criticism that they have no way of knowing if the papers of the people they hire are legal.
We are absolutely dependent on legal immigrant workers to make this Cape Cod work during the summertime. I agree with that. And we say in our motion that legal immigrants, regardless of race, creed, color, or country of origin, are always welcome in Sandwich, and we'll do whatever we can to help them become part of the Sandwich community. It's the illegal aliens that we are concerned about.
Well, in fact, so concerned that your motion proposes fining any business operating in Sandwich $1,000 for each illegal immigrant found in the employ of that business. What legal standing do you have? Because some immigration analysts are saying that this is actually a federal responsibility and that you don't have a legal standing.
It is a federal responsibility. We do understand that. It's constitutionally a federal responsibility. And this Board of Selectmen is saying to our Republican president, our Republican-controlled House and Senate, that we are not satisfied with what's being done. And by the way, this is a five Republican board of selectmen in Sandwich saying that to our Republican national executive and legislative branch.
So is this more a symbolic gesture than anything?
It may well end up that way, but it still sends a very strong message irrespective of that.
Randy Hunt is chair of the Board of Selectmen in Sandwich, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod. The board recently passed a motion that says the town should be declared not a sanctuary for illegal immigrants. Well, we turn now to Elena Latona. She's executive director of the organization Centro Presente, a group that advocates for Central and Latin American immigrants, and recently was part of the effort to get the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts, to redeclare itself a sanctuary city for immigrants. She joins us from Cambridge. And first of all, Elena, what do you think of the motion in Sandwich?
I think most likely is part of this movement that seeks to continue to poison the environment, the political environment against immigrants. We're talking about a town that they themselves acknowledge do not even have an issue with undocumented immigrants.
And as you well know, on Cape Cod, there are many undocumented immigrants, and some say they fuel the tourist industry there. They say in Sandwich that, in fact, they see people losing business because they can't compete with people who pay people lower wages or pay them under the table.
Yes, and in neighboring towns like Hyannis, they also pointed out that without immigrants, they would not have enough workers to meet the demand for services in the Cape.
Well, we should say that Cambridge, where you are, originally declared itself a sanctuary city for immigrants in the 1980s when there was a flow of refugees from Central America because of the conflict there. So they were giving them refuge from that conflict. Why the effort now?
We were very concerned at the end of last year when the House of Representatives approved a measure that seeks merely to put undocumented immigrants in jail, deport them, and then build a massive wall with the border with Mexico. And we realized that the political climate was very noxious and that we needed to have deeper dialogues, more profound dialogues about the issue confronting immigrants so that we can debunk a lot of the myths and address, many of the lies that get propagated.
Well, and what exactly does it mean when you're a sanctuary city? We understand that it means that police can't hassle people, but what does that mean?
It means that, if you walk into a store, if you walk into a restaurant, you're engaging in conversation, if you go to the police department, you are not going to be viewed with suspicion, you are not going to be treated badly, you are not going to be subjected to humiliation.
We understand that unless an immigrant or anyone commits a crime, they won't be asked about their status. Children's schools and residents who use city facilities won't be asked about their status unless they commit a crime or they're accused of committing a crime. Well, we're sure you're aware of the backlash against the Cambridge City Council. The group Project USA has a website urging people to buy bus tickets for illegal aliens so that they can move from whatever city they're in to travel to Cambridge. They're talking about putting up billboards on the border, giving people directions to Cambridge and phone numbers to call in Cambridge, telling illegal immigrants to go directly to Cambridge.
To us, that's just very mean-spirited. It is about fomenting fear and fomenting hatred.
Elena Latona, executive director of the organization Centro Presente, advocating for immigrants in the Massachusetts area, and also behind the push to have Cambridge, Massachusetts, redeclare itself a sanctuary city for immigrants. Elena, outside of the debate, it does seem to illustrate that towns are trying to do something on their own, perhaps lacking any direction from the federal government. Do you feel a lack of direction from the federal government?
Cities and states are taking action, and it's either based on a vision that, recognizes that immigrants are first and foremost human beings, or based on the opposite vision that views immigrants as a threat, as a menace, and dehumanizes them.
Elena, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Oh, to be a kid again, with seemingly endless summer days sprawled out in front of you, lazy days spent reading. This month, we're recommending some wonderful children's titles, and today, books for kids from 3rd to 5th grade. Nina Lindsay is a librarian from the Oakland Public Library in Oakland, California. She'll be chairing the Newbery Award Selection Committee next year and joins us from the studios of Youth Radio in Berkeley, California. Nina, welcome.
Thank you.
Your first selection for 3rd to 5th graders, Baby Mouse Beach Babe by Jennifer and Matthew Holm. This is the third graphic novel for Baby Mouse. It's sort of Art Spiegelman for little kids. Graphic novels, hard to find for this age group, even though they love them.
Everyone loves graphic novels. This age group is particularly drawn to them as graphic novels are getting bigger and bigger in the American publishing market and in libraries, too. But what's lacking is a graphic novel written particularly for this age group. We now have it with Baby Mouse. She is on summer vacation, finally. Things aren't quite as glamorous as she imagines them to be.
Well, we want to hear a little bit of it. And by the way, it's a beautiful, spare, black, white, and pink book. Here's 9-year-old Haley Ehrenfeld reading an excerpt of Baby Mouse Beach Babe.
Do you know how to surf, Baby Mouse?
Sure. I read all about it. Paddle, paddle, put your whiskers into it, Baby Mouse. I just have to catch a wave. Look at that. Wow, check her out. This is fun. Baby Mouse? Aha! Crash.
Nina, why do you think these stories appeal to children?
This is the sort of story that kids love. Friendship, sibling rivalry, wanting a little bit of glamour in their lives, as every kid does during the summer. And it's in a format that they want and is very engaging.
Okay, so Baby Mouse Beach Babe, first pick. Next up, The Clue of the Linoleum Lederhosen by M.T. Anderson. It's a spoof on popular series books like Goosebumps and The Hardy Boys. It's about some little adventurers whose life is so exciting that vacation just pales. Their mom tries to cheer them up with a fake rubber hand. Here's 9-year-old Sophie Lander reading from The Clue of the Linoleum Lederhosen.
What did you kids do all day?
Good question, said Katie. It's vacation and we're bored out of our minds. Mrs. Mulligan waved her rubber wrist in the air. Well, that's why I was trying to cheer you all up a little. By sawing off your own hand, said Jasper. You girls didn't even jump, said Katie's mom. Because we see it all the time, said Katie. She groaned, all the time.
Katie Mulligan is the star of her own fictitious series, Horror Hollow. She has that mother who likes to saw off her own hand, and she leads them away on vacation to escape their exciting lives. But, of course, their vacation turns out to be all the more exciting. Jasper gets into some trouble and is nearly asphyxiated by his own snot. It goes on for pages and pages. It's wonderful. It's really just a lot of craziness and a lot of fun.
Anytime there's a book where somebody almost gets asphyxiated by snot, I'm saying, let's read that book. Okay, finally, a nonfiction, Team Moon, How 400,000 People Landed Apollo 11 on the Moon. It's by Catherine Thimmish. 9-year-old Noah Miller-Medson, our producer Karen Miller-Medson's son, has this reading.
Space, it's dangerous out there. Micrometeoroids, radiation, airlessness, and coming home would be no picnic either. The compact car-sized space capsule would be greeted by searing white-hot flames as it slammed madly back down to Earth.
The beautiful thing about this book is the way it's designed. It lets you enter the story from different places, and I think this is a book that will last kids all summer long, if not all year long, diving into each potential disaster that was averted in landing Apollo 11 on the moon.
It could be a kid's first coffee table book. I mean, it's really beautiful, the way it's
Absolutely.
Laid out. Well, before we let you go, we have to ask you about perhaps the most highly anticipated event, at least in our house. Everybody's waiting for the new Captain Underpants.
Yes, Captain Underpants and the Preposterous Plight of the Purple Potty People. And try saying that 10 times fast. We've been waiting 3 years for this one. It's due out in mid-August. If you don't know Captain Underpants, there's probably a good reason. This is kind of the kid's underground hero. He's the school principal of George and Harold, and in the very first book, they hypnotize him and turn him into Captain Underpants. He takes off all his clothes, including his toupee, but leaving on his underpants, puts on a cape, and sets out to save the world with wedgie power.
Potty humor for this age, this is a real draw. This gets them to books.
Oh, of course, because it's taboo.
Nina Lindsay, librarian from the Oakland Public Library in Oakland, California, with her recommendation for children in grades 3 to 5 for summer reading. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. In America, small farms taken over by conglomerates or forced to shut down by changes in the marketplace. But in a spectacular new book of photographs, John Francis Ficarra captures the plight of black farmers in America who say they've also faced decades of discrimination from, among others, the United States Department of Agriculture. You might remember images of the protests by black farmers in Washington in the 1990s, with wagons and mules and farmers taken away in handcuffs. There was also a class action lawsuit against the USDA charging racial inequality in the distribution of farm loans. But despite a victory in that case, the numbers of black farmers have continued to dwindle. Well, photos of some of the remaining farmers and their protests are now collected in Black Farmers in America. You can see some of the pictures at our website, here-now.org. And photographer John Francis Ficarra joins us from WAMU in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Good to be with you.
Well, we're also joined by someone you focused your lens on, Willie Adams. He's, in fact, on page 65, a chicken farmer from Greensboro, Georgia. He joins us on the phone as well. Hi, Willie.
Hey, how you doing, Robin?
I'm good. And I'm wondering, I'm looking at your picture. You're wandering through, well, you tell me what that is. It looks like a chicken barn.
Yes, it's a chicken house there with about 25,000 chickens in it.
How long have you been farming, and had your family been in farming?
Yes, I'm a fourth generation farmer, and I've been in farming business myself all my life, and I was in the poultry business for 29 years on up to about a year ago.
The poultry business, but then what happened?
The company I was with, they sold out and moved further south from me, and the other company that bought it said they didn't need any old houses, they wanted new houses.
These are the chicken houses.
Right, and that cost more money,
yeah.
You know.
How are you feeling about your future as a farmer?
It don't look too good. Well, what I'm trying to do now is grow natural pork and beef. If I can find a supporter of that, you know, some company or whatever that would buy it from me, to try to stay on the farm.
Yeah. Juan Williams writes the introduction to your book, John, and in it he talks about the special aura of farming for African Americans. Right after slavery, freed blacks were offered 40 acres and a mule, and the thought of getting their own land to farm was just, you know, spectacular at the time. But that promise was then rescinded after Lincoln was killed.
Well, it's, you know, it was the first of a series of broken promises, and African Americans have a great history when it goes back to farming.
40 acres and a mule was the promise of the first land they could work for themselves as opposed to working someone else's land.
Absolutely. And at that time, that was really the, as one writes, nobody can confuse a landowner for a slave.
Willie Adams, is there a part of your family holding on to this land because it was so dear to get it?
Yes, that's one reason. And another reason, I have children, and I want them to have something.
Yeah. Well, what'd you think when this, and I'm looking at the book flap, at this Caucasian fellow, John Francis Ficarra, with his camera, what'd you think when he came to take pictures of you?
Oh, I was just blown away. See, I've been knowing John for a number of years before then with the struggle when we was going back and forth to Washington, D.C. and whatever. And when I read, I knew he was going to do a book. But when I read it and saw the pictures in it, I was just blown away, especially with the information he had, because he hit the nail right on the head. If you read the book, I mean, nobody did no better job than what he did.
Well, high praise, John, and I'm flipping through the pictures. There's Charles Williams in Sumter County, Alabama, carrying his pail through his fields. Why did you take this up? And tell us a little more about the struggle that Willie talks about.
At the moment, all family farms are struggling under now what is coming to dominate the agricultural landscape, and that is corporate farming. So all family farms are struggling. Black farmers are obviously going out of business 3 and 4 times quicker than their white counterparts.
Well, you say obviously. Why obviously?
They have not only suffered the same predicaments as their white counterparts, and that is, you know, weather and other things that affect their crops. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, they've had to deal with racial discrimination at the county levels from USDA and other financial lending institutions, which are there actually to help black farmers and help all family farms.
Did you come across that, Mr. Adams? Did you come across, or do you know people who've come across families who've tried to get loans and feel that they were turned down because they were black?
Oh, yes, yes, in a number of cases, even myself. In a situation where I come in, when I would go and apply for a loan, There'd be a piece of land for sale, not too far from me, but by the time they would say, well, they would put you off, and the time period would go by, and it takes so long or whatever, and they'd just wear you out. You apply for something, and then you say, if you act with $10,000, they say, well, we only can make it loan for $5,000, or either we don't have no funds available, that type of thing.
Mm. Right. That's really all well, very well documented now in the class action suit.
Well, and in 1997, the Black Farmer and Agriculturist Association filed this class action lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture, alleging that the government showed racial bias when distributing farm loans and subsidies. And in 1999, a judge ordered the USDA to pay millions in claims. Have they? Has the USDA done that?
They've started to do that, but I believe there's still about 40% of the farmers who had put in claims that are still waiting on their monies or waiting to have their claims addressed.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, you have taken their pictures. I'm looking at Harry and Donald Means, looks like father and son in Greene County, Alabama,
yes.
Two strikingly well-dressed men in front of what looks like a herd of steer.
A herd. Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be doing quite well.
Yeah, they were doing very well, and they had a rather large cattle operation.
And on the other hand, page 63, Cleveland Jackson, is he the fellow who patched the inner tube of his tire over and over?
Yes, Cleveland Jackson is a sugarcane farmer down in Louisiana, and Cleveland had a sugarcane harvester that was so old, and he maintains that when he can no longer fix that harvester is when he will go out of business. The cost of a new harvester is, well into the $200,000 range.
Right. Willie Adams, I just want to bring you back in to the conversation. You said, one of the reasons you want to make a go of it is because you have children.
Right.
And I'm thinking, though, for many people, the wish is that your children do better than you. And I am understanding that one of the issues with all farmers, and in particular with African-American farmers, is that the children don't want to farm. They want to move up in life.
Yes, because they see the struggle what the parents have, just like myself. They look around and see me, struggling and can't get money when I need it from, different agencies and whatever like that. So it's really just another type of job or whatever.
Really, your sense, you said John Ficarra hit on the head in this. What is it? What is it about the pictures? I'm looking at faces looking out under tarps, through pickup windows, from tractors.
Well, I see history, basic history there. Heritage that we all have, shared, the farmers, the pictures there.
So you see history. John, what do you see? I'm looking, for instance, at Alan Gooden, just a full-frame face looking back at me. What do you see?
Well, for me, this was about history. And for me, this story was about a way of life that really is disappearing quite rapidly. And as a photojournalist and a documentary photographer, when I looked at the statistics of black farmers going out of business, and when I also compare those with the statistics of young farmers, black farmers going into farming or continuing to farm, it was clear to me that this was an end, for all time. And all family farms are struggling right now. Black farmers are going to be out of business way before anybody else.
John Francis Ficarra, his coffee table-shaped, beautiful book is called Black Farmers in America, with an essay, a foreword by Juan Williams. And pictured in the book, Willie Adams, who is still farming in Georgia, is it, Willie?
Greensboro, Georgia, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin. It's good to be with you.
Okay, thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll hear two.